This show comes to you from the Art of Change Skills for Life. Visit www.artofchange.com to explore how you might grow your communication and leadership skills through workshops, coaching, and more. Plus, you get to work with me. My guest is an actor, director, and stage skills coach from San Antonio, Texas, who has been improvising for audiences both nationally and around the world for 29 years. With specialties in improvised musical theater, grounded and character-driven scene work, he has coached hundreds of kids, teens, students, adults for years to multiple performance successes. He's also super active in the PTA, and none of that is why I invited him here today. I often invite guests because of their notoriety, who they are, what they do, their interest to you. But the guest I've invited today is my friend, and I know his story, or at least I think I do. And I remember when everything changed. My guest is Estevan J. Chewy Sarate. I'm Aiden Nipom. This is the Changed Podcast. Welcome to the show, Chewy.
Well, thank you so much. What a great introduction, man. Golly, you are so professional.
Thank you. I first of all, thank you for being here. I mean, it's sure. It's the world is what it is. I don't know what else you would have had planned, but you are very active with your kiddos, and so I appreciate your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Sundays are always good. I don't want to break the fourth wall, but it is a Sunday. they're usually less busy than most. So that's, I'll make time for you, Aiden. You kidding me?
for listeners, Chewy and I have known each other for a number of years. I haven't done any math. I'd have to actually think about it and do
probably
some adding and subtracting,
10.
But it might be 10. But we taught together mm-hmm. at the improv school where I used to teach in Austin, and we have been on stage together many times. So we have an improv connection.
For sure.
But we've also been in other places in the world at the same time because of both being traveling performers.
That's true. We were in Alaska together.
For the
festival up there in Juneau. And you and your troupe were nice enough to actually ask me, or I kind of bullied my way in to performing with y'all that that time. It was fantastic. I had one of the best times I've ever had on stage.
Chewy, you sing like an angel.
Oh, shut it. You.
No, you. Say okay. It.
Well,
you
we,
seem like
that?
An angel.
That's actually one of the few shows I remember almost everything that happened during it, because I'm not a big, when I go on stage, my eyes kind of roll back in my head, and then afterwards people tell me, wow, that was so funny that you did that. I was like, what did I do exactly? I don't remember. I really don't remember a lot of things, but I remember that one just because it was such a funny setup, like this butcher who was giving STDs to all the ladies in the neighborhood.
it was the 1950s, so we had to dance around it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that scene where the two of y'all are talking about it, but not talking about it. There was a scene where you're like, yes, but no. Y'all just stuttered for 3 minutes. It was hilarious. I was dying on the side. I mean, I guess you probably had to be there.
That's one of the things that's so magical about the art form of improv in theater is that that show only ever happens once based on a single suggestion from the audience. It never happens again. And so you're like you, I often forget what happened because it's in a conversation, you remember the gist of what was said, but you don't always remember mm-hmm. what was actually said. But I remember a lot more from that particular show than I do from many others. Could be because I've watched the video.
Oh, you've seen the video. Yeah, I never did see the video of it, I don't think. I hate going back and watching myself on stage. So it's
do you?
I really do. I probably won't even listen to this later on because I can't stand my voice. You say I sing like an angel, but in my head, it's just like, what note are you on, idiot?
really?
I don't know. It's some sort of self-doubt thing in me that I can't shake, that I just can't stand looking at myself because I'll be so critical.
Back when I thought I was going to try and be on Saturday Night Live. Before my experience of being a cast member at Esther's Follies, when I was like, oh, this is like a third of the amount of pressure of Saturday Night Live. If I can't if I can't handle this, there's no way I can handle that.
Yeah.
And so I changed directions. But back at that time, like I was taking all kinds of workshops for trying to be comfortable on camera, and just putting a camera in front of me, like flop sweat, just like, and yeah. stuttering, and like, it was very uncomfortable. So, you know, this podcast and putting it onto YouTube and editing all of it has really helped me feel totally comfortable on camera in a way I never could do before this project.
Well, see, that's one of the positive things about this whole virus thing.
Sure.
The quarantine, we've had to get a little more comfortable with cameras, haven't we? Because you don't get to see people in person. So,
would you be willing to prove to the audience that you're a singer?
Okay.
Because
okay, you just want me to sing something, is what you're saying?
Yeah, maybe this is just selfish on my part. I love hearing you sing.
Okay. If you ever change your mind about leaving me behind, oh, bring it to me. Bring your sweet love and bring it on home to me.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. I love that song.
Awesome.
Yeah. I guess that wasn't so bad. Thanks. I fronted a band, for God's sake, and I still worry about my voice all the time. Like, my whole excuse whenever I was in the band was like, okay, I'm singing, but they can't really hear me over the music. It's good. The musicians are great. I'll be fine.
I mean, when you're in a band, that's actually true, because the lead guitar is always trying to break amplifier.
That bastard.
No. I've been in a couple of bands, and it was always like the sound guy would come out of the booth on the breaks and be like, please tell the guitar player to turn it down. And I'm like, could you?
Yeah.
Could you tell him? Because
he ain't gonna listen to me.
So Chewy, you're an actor, not like outside of improv. You have an extensive background in performing arts, but also an extensive background as an improviser. How do you feel about this idea of change, like the broad idea, like when people talk about embracing change or dealing with change or whatever? How do you feel about that, or what does that bring up for you in a sort of general way?
Well, in general, I'm for change. I think it has to happen. It often scares the hell out of me when something changes, for sure. And I mean, if you just want to talk about something as loose as improv, when I lived in Austin before, you know, there was like 5 troops in town. When I came back 7 years later, there was more like 30 or 40. And now there's upwards of like 200 troops in town. I mean, I don't know what COVID's going to do to all that, but there's a lot of people actively playing in the city of Austin. And so that kind of change was kind of a shock to me. I was like a goldfish thrown in a new tank, you know, and I had to learn how to acclimate. And it was scary. It was really scary, especially being a little older now, you know, and knowing things and knowing I'm going into situations where I'm gonna have to be very humble until people realize who the fuck I am. I'm sorry, can I say that? Oh my God.
Yeah, you can actually.
Oh, okay, good.
I'll just flag it. Yeah.
I won't say anymore if I can help it. But people not knowing who I am, you know, and it was hard. It was really, really hard, because I had established myself pretty well when I left town, and I had established myself in San Antonio when I left for there, and then I had to start all over again. So that was like very severe change for me. And seeing how welcoming everybody was, and how like nice everybody was in town, which has changed a little bit. It's not quite as nice as it used to be, but that was something completely foreign to me. If you were doing improv in this town in the late 90s, like early 2000s, you wanted nothing more than to be the person who gets picked for that HBO showcase, and to hell with your friends. Like you don't care if anybody else gets it. It was a dog eat dog thing for stage time too. And, you know, well, hopefully now we'll have a lot of stages in town. We were lucky enough to have like 5. Just those kind of huge changes happened, but this one happened so quick, you know, so I had to learn how to acclimate quicker. And I think I'm getting better about that, you know.
Not as
afraid of change as I used to be, but I am definitely afraid of it sometimes.
That's good. So you have a big family-ish. Family. You got a gaggle of youngins, although your oldest is like all grown up.
17. Yeah, yeah, he's 17. I didn't really feel old when he was 16. And now that he's 17, I feel old because it's like, oh my God, 18 is right around the corner. He's an adult. Mm-hmm. He's not an adult. How in the world is he going to be an adult in the world? I feel like as a parent, you worry that you haven't prepared them enough, you know? Mm-hmm. And I grew up in strife, you know, like my family was poor. I had a single mom and she was a teacher, and we wanted for things. We were poor, but we weren't the poorest. They don't understand strife at all. My wife and I have worked really hard so that even when we're having financial difficulties, they have no idea. Like they have no idea how bad it can get. And
yeah,
I just worry that because they haven't ever like had something, they haven't had loss really in their life. And I'm worried about that for them. I mean, every parent worries about their kids. You always worry about your kids, but
it's part of the job.
Yeah, it's part of the job. I don't know that I will ever stop. And he's going to be 18. My God. Ugh. He doesn't even drive yet. Well, we haven't had time to teach him, but still.
Have you noticed that amongst your kiddos that one is more flexible and adaptable than another?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yes. My oldest and my youngest are pretty staunch on what they will do and not do. My middle kid, if it's good for the family, he'll change what he's doing and change for that. Like he's very good at that. If we need somebody to do some dishes, he'll do them. If we need somebody to, you know, watch the little brother, he'll do it. You know, the older one, he's got his own agenda. He wants to do what he wants to do. And if it gets in his way, he gets angry about it, which is totally me coming through him. I've got a bad angry streak and my wife does too. But then the little guy, he's 8. And so he's 8 in a family of a 17 and a 15-year-old kid. So he's kind of grown up by himself. So he hasn't been told no a lot. I'm not going to lie. Like we kind of did that third child syndrome thing where we just kind of let him go and see what happened. And he's super intelligent. He's fine. He's had more screen time than any child should ever have, but he's great. Like we're not worried about it, you know?
Yeah.
But he gets, you know, because he gets ignored, he does his thing. And when you try to change his thing, he's like, whoa, how dare you? How dare you come over here and try to change what I have established as a thing because of your terrible parenting. you've ignored me and now I've done this and you're trying to change it. It's like, yeah, well, sorry, kid.
I often wonder, you know, most of the people who have been excited to come on this show have been like fairly adaptable and get excited about change. A few have had this like more afraid of change perspective, mm-hmm. which it sounds like is in there a little bit for you. But
yeah, I can't help but wonder.
Yeah, I can't help but wonder how much the whole like nature versus nurture conversation when it comes mm-hmm. to personality and psychology in general. I wonder also how much. Because this show is sparked because of a conversation that I had with my stepdaughter who mm-hmm. really struggles with change in general. It's like once one mm-hmm. thing happens one time, that's how it's supposed to be forever. Yeah. And yesterday we were having what happens now every season. We had the like horrible drama related to changing the shoes, the changing Ooh. Of the shoes for this season.
Changing of the shoes. She doesn't like to change her shoes.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. No, she's like, yeah, she doesn't. Once she's wearing them, it's like, so now we're in sneakers and this is mm-hmm. This is for the next week. We're going to be dealing with her processing that she wants mm-hmm. to be wearing her sandals, but also it's 40 degrees out and raining.
Got to cover the toes.
They're not the right shoes anymore.
Yeah.
But she'll be processing that. We're indoors 99% of the time. So it's like, put on your shoes so we can go for a walk and get our fresh air and exercise mm-hmm. for the day, inmate. And, you know, it's like, and she's going to have like these melt for about a week. And then she's fine until next spring when we have to do the changing of the shoes because the sneakers will be worn out and have holes in them. Because, you know, she wears those shoes.
Sounds like she just gets used to things, you know? And maybe that's the thing that I have too, is that I get very used to a certain way of doing things. And I've got, I mean, everybody always says I've got a little bit of OCD in me for sure. You know, I need things a certain way. And a lot of it goes to what my story is, honestly, a lot of that, the repetition of things. And then when things go out of whack, you're like, what is happening right now? Why is this a thing? And so you have to adapt to it. But I take forever to do that sometimes. Not every time, but sometimes I take forever to do that.
Well, now is probably a great time. So Chewy, unlike most of my guests where I don't know what story they're about to tell, this is for me going to be more about the details than the broad strokes. But I, well, we'll talk about it afterwards. Please tell us a story from your real life, a fork in the road moment after which things changed for you.
Sure. So I'd worked in bars for about 20 years or so, and I established myself as a person who was in the industry in town and was well known in that. And with that industry, it's a lot of partying. You've got fast money in your hand. And so you take the money and you have to decompress because you're dealing with people who are at their worst, basically. When people are in a bar, they are basically like their worst behaved selves. And so you're constantly dealing with that pressure, and then you go get off and you just want to relax, so you drink. And, you know, or some people go to drugs. It's a very, very, the industry is almost a gateway drug in itself. I'd been going along and I'd been drinking, and this 20 years of doing this, just like it was not a thing. I had, you know, two kids and then a third, and, you know, everything was going fine. I just was a drinker, you know. I never thought necessarily that I was drunk or anything like that. I had this like superpower that nobody could really ever tell when I was drunk. Like I always used to joke that, you know, when the aliens come down from the sky and challenge the Earth to the great drinking contest to save all of humanity, I will be that champion, and statues will be erected in my honor, you know, because like I will have pushed off the alien horde. I had a head for alcohol, and through that, my body decided I don't. And so I have cirrhosis of the liver, which is basically your liver has so much scar tissue from damage that it's been done by alcohol that it can't function properly. And a lot of people need a transplant when it comes to this sort of thing. Now, the way I found out is an interesting story. I tripped in a parking lot. I hurt my toe really bad, and I thought I pretty much broke it. And so I went to have x-rays done, and this doc at a doc in the box, which is one of those like little urgent care places, you know, they're not really a hospital, not really a doctor's office. And they prescribed me 6,400 milligrams of ibuprofen a day to take, which is an astronomical amount. It's way more than anybody should be taking. And, I started feeling kind of meh. I started getting random nosebleeds, which were really strange to me because I hadn't gotten those before. And so I was like, I better go. I must be having like some serious sinus problems. I need to go to my doc and see what's going on. So I went in and I walked in and I talked to her. And like within about 5 seconds, she's like, I want you to go have a sonogram on your liver. You're very yellow. I can see it on you. Your eyeballs are yellow. Your skin is yellow, which is a symptom of cirrhosis. Your body gets jaundiced. Because obviously you're not secreting the right things to your skin, and your bilirubin level goes very high, and it's very, very dangerous. So I did that day. I went and I had my sonogram done, you know, and it was around 4 o'clock, and I have a habit of always going to watch Jeopardy at the bar, like with my buddies. Old guy bar habit, you know, like everybody sit around and answer questions. Don't say the last answer, damn it. Get ready to chance. Once the song's over, you can answer. We had rules and everything. And I was sitting there and I get a call, and it's like 30 minutes after my sonogram, I get a call from my doctor, and I answer thinking it's the nurse saying, you know, everything's okay. She's just going to tell you, you know, take this, take that, whatever. and it's my doctor, and she's on the phone. So that spooked me, and I was outside at this point on the phone, and she tells me, you've got cirrhosis of the liver. And in my head, all I heard was, you're going to die. And it scared the living shit out of me. pardon my cussing again. But I went back in, and I was just kind of stunned as I sat back at the bar. And I hadn't been drinking that day because she had told me to go get this liver sonogram. And I was stupid, but I'm smart enough to know that maybe I shouldn't be adding to this if it's going to be an issue. Maybe somewhere in my head I knew that this was the time for the diagnosis. But I was sitting there, and I looked around, and I looked at the bar, and like my first habit in any bad news would be to get a drink, like immediately, and just drink it away. And I looked around, and all the bottles and all the taps and all the drinks just disappeared. They were blurry. I couldn't see them because I didn't need it anymore. I didn't need it, and I didn't want it anymore. I thought about my kids, and I thought about them living with someone else as their father, and it made me sad. It made me really sad that they would tell good stories. They'd say how nice I was and how fun I was, you know, and that, but man, he really couldn't keep his booze. And so he died, you know. That's such a terrible story, as opposed to my dad's, you know, here to toast at my wedding, you know. And so I quit right then. I stopped, and I never had another drink since then. It's been in almost 4 years now. And the only times I've had a drink were on accident. There was one time we were in a bar in Oklahoma City that four drinks that were identical got sat down on the table. And the person serving the drink was very sure that that was the one without alcohol in it. I took a sip, it was alcohol. Freaked me the hell out. I had to leave the bar and go sit in the car and cry. Because I thought, you know, you've done all this work, you've done all these things, and now you drank, you blew it. You blew it. And knowing in my head I wasn't going to die from one sip of alcohol, but the taste, everything, it just sent me back to what that felt like and how much I miss it, honestly, you know? And I felt the warmth as it goes down your stomach like I hadn't felt since I was like, you know, 19. So here I am now. When I was first diagnosed on my MELD score, which is the score that they use to determine whether or not you need a transplant or not, it goes from 6 to 40. With 6 being normal, and then 40 being you're gonna die. You know, you need to get a transplant immediately. I was at like a 36 on that. And so through, you know, a little bit of change of diet and not drinking at all, and through medication and such, I've got my MELD score down to like an 8. So I'm a very bad candidate for a liver transplant right now because I don't need it. And I also, you know, I've been journaling now for a long time. I put my stuff on Instagram and Facebook, my daily journal that is just for me. It really is. I do write it for me, but along the way, people have started reading it, and I get a lot of calls and a lot of you know, messages from people who want me to talk to a family member for them about it, or maybe they think they have a problem as well. And so I've actually helped some people, counsel them out of this nonsense. It's a dark, dark place to be. And the best person to take you out of it is probably somebody who's experienced it, especially who's living with the fact that they're probably going to die because of it. Like, that will be the thing that killed me eventually, is alcohol. And I know that now. Didn't know it then. I was having a great time. But yeah, I wrote a one-man show, or one-person show, excuse me, one-person show about it, and did it at a festival locally here, and I plan to expand that and maybe tour it once everything calms down to colleges, because I think binge drinking is where it starts, and there's a road, like you talk about that change and that road that you can take. One road is, you know, you just drink in college and you leave it at that, and then you have, you know, social drinking. The other is you drink, and you drink for the rest of your life, and you know those people. And it happens a lot of time when you get to that independence, that free choice of what you want to do. And also, frankly, it's built into your head for a lot of people. This thing's a disease. So yeah, I know I'm sober, and I'm very happy about that. I haven't had any alcohol in forever. I miss it.
And you actually have been counting the days. What day are we on today?
You have to ask me that.
As of this recording.
As of this recording, today is 1335. So 1,335 days sober.
That's awesome.
Which sounds like a lot, You know, it sounds like a lot of days. But first of all, I'm still not caught up with how many years I was drinking. But second of all, I hear that about these alcoholics who now are like 15 years sober, 20 years sober, 25 years sober. And it just blows me away that they waited. They didn't come back to it at all. Mm-hmm. And I don't see myself being that way still to this day, which is why I know I have to keep like writing that journal. I keep thinking about it a lot, because if I start thinking that, I can have a sip here or there, you know, it's not a big deal anymore. My liver's getting better. You know, let's give it a test and see how I do. I know that's just another, that's a way that I don't want to travel. I don't want to go down that road. It's going to be a very, very hard road to get back from. Cause you also hear about people who've been 10 years, 15 years, 20, 25 years sober that slip up and start drinking again, which is even more astounding to me that, you know, you would think this is like, now you're in your muscle memory. You don't even think about alcohol anymore. Well, that's not true. Alcoholics think about it all the time, whether we like to or not. Sometimes it's kind of thrown in your face a lot, but it is what it is.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you for sharing that story.
Sure.
I think, you know, at this point you do tell your story quite a bit, so I don't know how vulnerable to tell your story that feels, particularly now that you're staging it, which is exciting.
Yeah. You can go anywhere you want. Are you talking about a question to ask or anything? Just, I'm fine. I could talk about it.
Mostly, I just want to sort of acknowledge the reality of sharing that. That's like, because it's an invisible thing. It's like, you know, if we're at a festival party, everyone's drinking around you. Not everyone, right? Not everyone.
People,
we know
though,
a fair number, but like majority of people
absolutely
are drinking. And it's invisible, and it's, unless we know you and, you know, unless you tell the story. And I think that's one of the things that really strikes me about it. Like even smoking is easier to hide, quitting smoking is an invisible thing, but it's just a lot less damn. I mean, I don't know. It's everything will kill you eventually, but it's an invisible thing that you, it's like, you don't get an army of people with you on this. It's you. Your army of people.
Because you make your own choices. And, you know, if your choice is to drink, then you know there are going to be consequences of your choices. If your choice is to stay off of it, there are other consequences there too that are good, maybe, or maybe even some bad ones. Who knows? I don't know. I don't know a bad consequence for not drinking. I really don't. But, but the consequences are there, and it's up to you to make the decision and to get your mental disease in check. Frankly, you have a chemical imbalance probably if you're an alcoholic. They're pretty, the studies are coming out daily about more and more study about it and how it is a disease and it is genetic and it is, you know, something that you have to fight. You have to actively fight. Some people take medication for it, believe it or not, to have an aversion to alcohol. Like if they have alcohol in their body, they immediately throw up, that kind of thing. It is an invisible thing. You wouldn't look at me and know that I'm an alcoholic. You know, you can. Look
well,
at some
and more
people.
Importantly, I knew you when you were drinking, and I never in a million years would have even identified you as a drinker, which was how you identified yourself as opposed to a drunk. But like in a million years, I wouldn't have been like, oh, that Chewy, he's sloppy. Like never in a million years. And my memory of some of that time was like, you were like, there was a lot of doctor's visits. There's a lot of like weird stuff happening. You were just trying to explain what was going on. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if a little bit that diagnosis coming back was like, was there any level of relief in just knowing what had happened?
Oh, wow. That's such an interesting question. I've never.
Because I remember at that time, this sense of like hanging mystery of like, why am I getting nosebleeds?
Yeah. If I look back at it now, yes, I guess there was a relief. I mean, I'm glad I'm where I'm at. Let me put it that way. I'm relieved now that I knew then and didn't actually die. So, because if I had kept going like I was going, I had a year, they told me flat out, They're like, you will die in a year if you keep drinking this way. And they, everybody said, every alcoholic says, they told me the same thing. You know, they do say that because it's true. It's true. If you keep going that way, you're going to die. And the one thing I've learned about this, about through all this for sure, is that you trust your doctors, you trust your nurses, you listen to them. They know what they're talking about. And yeah, now that I think about it, I guess I do now have a relief. At the time, I probably didn't realize it. At the time, my life was crumbling because I thought that my life was alcohol. I thought I was defined by it. I thought that's what made friendships. I thought that's what kept my family together. Like it was the glue that was my life. So at the time, it was not a relief at all. It was more like, how am I going to give this up? How in the world am I going to give this up? And come to find out, it wasn't that hard for me. And that's different. That's very different. And I don't ever brag about that, because I feel for the people that can't do it, that can't see it, can't see it. I mean, you know,
I lost an uncle to cirrhosis of the liver, to alcoholism, however you want to be fair. It was a step uncle. I wasn't close. The only part of the story for me was like, it was like this conversation between the grown-ups about like, oh, Tom, you know, has this diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I have an uncle named Tom, you know, like that was, but then it was like, oh, within 3 months, he was of getting that diagnosis. He was gone because his choice was the opposite of your choice. So, I think this happens. People get the diagnosis and they choose to speed up the process by getting
more booze in. You're already down on yourself so much as an alcoholic, and then they tell you you've done something that's going to make you die, and you feel stupid, and you feel useless, and you feel like an idiot. And the one thing that you do when you feel that way is you drink to feel better or to hide the fact that you're feeling that way. You know, it's so funny. You were talking about, you had the family talking. There's no other time where people like if I'm an alcoholic, I'm drinking. We're just drinkers together, right? And you're like, Chewy is so much fun to drink with. My God, we have the greatest time at the bar. Then they die or they get sick, and people are all of a sudden like, oof, saw that coming. Man, that guy really had some problems.
Oh man, yeah.
He couldn't stop. You hear that all the time. And it's like, well, you know, it may have been hard for you and it's not your responsibility to tell them, but maybe you should have spoke up. Maybe you should have told your friend or your family member that you're worried about them, you know, rather than now looking back and acting like you had some sort of foresight that they didn't have. Because they don't have any foresight. They're not looking. An alcoholic's only looking to their next drink, flat out. I hate to admit this because, you know, I love you and I enjoyed our time together teaching, but really I was teaching to get to the drink. I was there because I had to be for money. And I liked it and it was fun, but really what my motivation in the back of my head was always a drink. You remember at those after lunches or whatever we would do, I'd have a drink every time.
After class, we would go to the brewery and have a beer.
A shot and a beer usually for me. Like, and I quietly would do it. Nobody would really notice.
And, nobody ever notices is the thing. Well, with you, nobody noticed. Nobody noticed. And the truth is that a lot of people don't notice a lot of that stuff because everyone's so worried about themselves all the time. You know, that brewery had barbecue and people are like, what sandwich am I getting? And also I have all these thoughts about my own performance in improv class. And nobody's like, what's Chewy drinking?
Right. Exactly. And even if they were, I'd be so good at hiding it. Like alcoholics feel shame. At all times, most alcoholics know they shouldn't be doing it, and because you know you shouldn't be doing it, that whole child with a like trying to the cookie jar thing comes into your head, where you're like, "Well, I don't want anybody thinking bad about me, or I don't want anybody catching me doing this, so I'm going to do it on the sly." That's why alcoholics drink alone so much. You know, I used to have a bottle of Rumplemintz in my freezer at all times, and I'd go to the kitchen, have a shot, and that's after having been at the bar already for hours and hours, like. Probably 8 shots in plus a couple drinks and then go home and still pour myself triples with doing, you know, shots. And I wouldn't stop until I just kind of would fall asleep or pass out.
I imagine your relationship with your family has changed in a super significant way.
Yeah.
Based on this life change.
Well, with my sons, especially, it has changed quite a bit. because I look back at it and I get a lot of credit for being a really good dad, but I really haven't been a very good dad except for the last maybe 3 years. I don't remember much of the older ones' upbringings, honestly. And it's kind of sad. I have a point in my play where I talk about the fact that I don't remember any of their births. The first one because I was drunk. The second one because it just happened so quickly and I was probably hungover. You know, like he was 30 minutes, we were at the hospital, he was there. And then the fourth one, I was definitely drunk because I was up drinking with my father all night before the induction at 4 a.m. And and so I don't remember their births. And I actually apologized to them in the play. And
have you apologized to them in real life?
Yes. Yes. For
sure. What did they do with that? Like, what did kids do with that? How did they process that?
I don't think they understand it yet, but I think when they get older and they see how many friends of theirs have the same thing going on in their house and the parents don't apologize for it, you know, they'll realize that I really did mean it and I do mean it and I feel awful about it. Also, they read my journal. I mean, they know what I'm thinking almost at all times about this thing. So I'm very open about it. I don't know how I hope it affects them where they don't like do the opposite of what your parent does kind of thing, you know, like they go right. The other way. Cause I'm not puritanical about it. I've told them flat out, if you want to drink, that's fine, but know that you need to be careful. You need to watch how much you're drinking. And I've also told them, know that if I see a problem, I'm going to tell you. Like, yeah. I'm going to tell you, you're drinking too much, mijo. Like, you need to stop.
One of the things that you said before sharing the story was that you, a little bit, your feelings about change have changed. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I tell you what, I'm a lot more open to things than I ever was. I'm still very opinionated about things that I like and I don't like. And I'm very, yeah. very critical of movies and plays and improv, especially. I can't watch it a lot of times. I just can't because I'm being way too critical the entire yeah. time. I'm more open to listening than I ever was before because I can hear finally, you know? Mm. I think before I was so cloudy in my head that it didn't make any sense to me and I stuck to what I wanted to believe. And if I tried to change from that, it meant that I was showing weakness of some sort or they were gonna find me out. So mm-hmm. I stuck to it. I stuck to my guns about things. And to a real asshole point of view, point, honestly, I was kind of a prick when I was younger, especially. So I think I'm a lot nicer now. Maybe that's what's nicest about me changing is I'm nicer.
I mean, I thought you were nice before, but I definitely have noticed a softer quality to you over yeah. the last 3 years, including like manicures and pedicures and like
oh yeah
more adventurous things. And I don't remember you being a sneakerhead before.
I always have been a sneakerhead, but not practicing. You know, you know as an alcoholic you or as an addict of any sort, you try to substitute something for that habit. Because it is just yeah. a habit a lot of times for people. You just get into the groove of it and that's just what you do. And you don't think about it any other way. Well, I have like 60 some odd pair of sneakers now. And that comes from two things. One is that I enjoy it and it keeps me busy, you know, to look at shoes and that kind of thing and figure out what I would like. And two, because when I was a kid, I was poor. And I was on the basketball team and I couldn't afford the sneakers that the other guys had. And I used to make fun of it for it, you know. My mom, even on a teacher's salary, like I had to get the ones that they sold there at the school that were usually like some really cheap brand. And and my mom would usually be on like a payment plan for $35, you know, like she'd be like trying to pay the coach $5 a month or something like that. And so I never had them. And then I got money. I got a little bit of money and now I can afford a pair of shoes. And if I want to buy them, I do, if I can afford them at the time. And if I bought a pair when I was in Portland, when I saw you. Because Portland is so close to the headquarters of Nike. And
yeah, we got Nike, we got Adidas.
I know. I wanted to go to the Nike store so bad when I was up there, but I did end up getting a pair of nice Air Force Ones that I still wear to this day. And I remember they're from Portland because one, they're green, but two, they've got like a little pine tree on the sole, on the inside sole. It's uh-huh. really cool. I'm hoping it never rubs off. But but yeah, that there's that. And what was the other thing you said? Sneakers and manicures.
The manis and pedis.
You know, that happened as an accident, but yeah, definitely about like changing the way I felt about it. I lost a lot of weight by not drinking anymore. And because my body was so swollen and full of liquid, because my body couldn't process the liquid through my liver, like I lost a ton of weight. I lost almost 100 pounds, which I've gained back like a lot. I don't want to talk about how much I gained back, but
life is a roller coaster.
I started getting to wear clothes. Yeah, exactly. I started getting to wear clothes that I really liked more, you know, and, you know, as a big guy, there's only so many things you can pull off. And I started to be able to pull off other clothes that I've always wanted to wear. And so I had done this 48-hour marathon at the Hideout Theater, where we're 8 of us were on stage for 48 hours. You've done it, haven't you? Or no?
No, I've only participated as an incoming group to sort of sustain the energy of the Crazy Eight. But no, I would not. I don't think physically I could endure 48 hours of nonstop performance. I think my joints and my body would rebel. And the other thing that happens when I get really tired is I get dizzy. So I think I would fall and get hurt.
That's not good. Yeah. You probably shouldn't do it.
So I've never done it. I've always, but I've always wanted to. It's like,
it's a weird boast to have that, like, oh, I stayed up 48 hours doing improv. It's like, why, stupid?
You transcend the art form. Yeah. It's like your brain.
I mean, I don't know half of what happened in most of those shows, but either way, you talk about the physical like drain on you. Yeah, like I was done, and that day I was just like in pain, like all over my hands, my feet. Everything was in pain. And I was also, I was diagnosed at this time and I was going through my healing process. So I was hurting through the second marathon hard. The first marathon, I actually probably was going through a little bit of detox and didn't even realize it over the weekend.
Oh, wow.
But then, but then afterwards went back to drinking. Of course, first thing I did was go have a drink after the marathon the first time. My wife was going to get a manicure and I was like, hey, they do feet, right? And she was like, yeah. I was like, I'm gonna go with you. I'm gonna get a foot, like, thing done, the pedicure or manicure, pedicure. And so I did, and I didn't like that because I have neuropathy in my feet, which means your feet feel like they're asleep all the time. So it hurt.
Yeah.
It actually hurt. But then they asked me if I wanted to do my hands, and I was like, oh, fuck it, I'm here. And God, I'm cussing so much. I'm here, why not? And so they did it, and she asked if I wanted any color, and I was like, well, maybe just like a rainbow on my nail, because it was Pride Month, you know. Uh-huh. And then my wife said a month later she was going back, and I was like, let me go. And then it was like full on gel set.
That's so sweet. Well, Chewy, before we end our conversation, is there anything that you would like people to walk away from this conversation having learned, sort of your last thoughts here on change?
Yeah, I think the one thing that I've learned about change more than anything is that you have to remain humble. You have to be able to admit that you were wrong. You know, if the change is for the better, especially, you have to be able to give yourself to that and not feel shame about the fact that you were wrong. It's so easy to get bogged down in hating yourself because you made a bad choice, you know, and then the change doesn't really affect you like it should. Change should be a good thing when it all comes down to it. It should be something you look forward to. It should be for a better purpose than what you're living for at the time. With alcoholism, you gotta give in. You gotta admit it. You gotta admit that you have the problem, and you've gotta be willing to ask for help, because I was not a person who asked for help much at all. I'm still not very good about it, but I needed it. I needed help bad. And when I did reach out, I realized there's some great people who can help you out. You know, they know a lot more than you. You have to trust them, whether it be somebody from AA, if that's your thing, which AA is not my thing, but I still think it's a great organization and that you can learn a lot from it. If it's just a friend who's been through it, like, you know, me, like I get friends who call me, be ready to be humble and to admit that you're not as great as you think you are, maybe. And that helps you get better because you have something to strive for.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you being so open and sharing your thoughts today. And, you know, I am singing on the spot. I always enjoy it. I always enjoy you, Chewy. I appreciate you showing up for this.
I'm so honored to have been a part of it.
because Chewy is a friend of mine, I'm incredibly grateful that when presented with the need to change, he did. We often talk about change as something we could do for fun. Tired of your hair? Change it. Or for our own betterment. Tired of your job? Get a new career. But in some cases, betterment is about survival. According to the 2018 National Survey on Drug Use and Health, 14.4 million adults ages 18 and older had alcohol use disorder. We've lost a lot of Americans to non-preventable causes this year, but some causes of death are preventable, and an estimated 88,000 people, that's approximately 62,000 men and 26,000 women, die each year from alcohol-related causes, making alcohol the third leading completely preventable cause of death in the United States. If you or a loved one are struggling with alcohol abuse, I encourage you to seek help by contacting your local Alcoholics Anonymous, or you can call SAMHSA's National Helpline, also known as the Treatment Referral Routing Service, at 1-800-662-HELP. Thank you to my friend Chewy for sharing his story, and thank you for listening to the Changed Podcast. I'm Aiden Nipom, and I wish you the kind of experiences in life you're excited to tell stories about.